Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sean Strube, whose memoir is titled Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. Sean Strube is the founder of PAWS magazine, an activist for AIDS and gay rights, executive director of the Zero Project, and currently advisory editor of PAWS magazine, which is PAWS.com. Is there still hard copy of it?
It's printed in hard copy, not quite monthly. I think maybe it's eight times a year now. And about three quarters of the people with HIV in the U.S. hit the website or read the magazine every month.
Sean Strube, let's talk at first about the memoir, and then I want to go into some more current issues because you're still involved in activism. The memoir is pretty much in depth. Were you keeping diaries? Were you keeping notes over the years?
Not really. I kept a calendar, and that was very helpful. I went back and, you know, sort of plotted out things I'd noted on my calendar. Then I looked at news reports, you know, the highlights of each year, what was happening. That prompted a lot of memories. And I went back and talked to a lot of people from earlier in my life, people in some cases that I hadn't been in touch with for 20 and 25 years. And the pieces sort of began to fill in that way. And then, of course, during the PAWS era, you know, it was all pretty well documented because of the magazine. And I had a lot of old files that I went through, but not a diary.
You started out as a political junkie. You went to Washington as a teenager as a page, which was kind of fascinating because we don't get to see what it's like as a page, certainly not as a gay page slipping off here and there. Obviously, Washington itself, what really happens in Washington is very different from the Washington that we see in the newspapers in many ways, right?
Right. But the time when I arrived in Washington, you know, I was 17 years old. It was the spring of 1976. It was sort of a time of national renewal. You know, we had gotten past Watergate and the constitutional crisis that it engendered. The Vietnam War was over. Jimmy Carter was running for president, you know, promising that I would never lie to you, as he said. And it was a very exciting time for an idealistic, you know, young person who sort of, I grew up in Iowa City near a college campus, so anti-war protests and civil rights marches were part of my childhood. So it was very exciting. I thought it was a very high calling and great opportunity to be in Washington. It was the bicentennial year. But now, looking back, what seemed like a moment of national renewal was really sort of the tail end of a window closing on liberalism for a generation.
At that particular time, you were also trying to deal with your sexuality and coming out. You weren't really quite out, and you sort of stayed half in, half out, which kind of makes sense given that you were in Washington. What you saw was a lot of closets.
Well, that was the world that I sort of, when I first started to meet gay people, it was, you know, people on Capitol Hill, people working for members of Congress, some members of Congress as well. And it wasn't an activist community. It didn't have a gay political consciousness at all. And in fact, the reverse. It was really rejecting of that. I quickly figured out that as I was becoming interested in gay and lesbian rights as a social justice issue, that I had to keep that quiet or risk being ostracized from the, you know, new circles of ambitious, young, but closeted gay people I was meeting.
Did you meet a lot of gay Republicans, closeted Republicans, who were very, very homophobic on the surface?
Well, at that time, no more so than closeted Democratic people in Washington. You know, up until the early 80s, the closeted gay social scene in Washington didn't divide ideologically. You could be at a party and there'd be the, you know, most extreme right-wing people there with people who are more progressive, because the closet and the stigma and fear of the closet was far more community building, as it were, than ideological differences. But I quickly became aware of, you know, people like Terry Dolan, you know, who was the head of the National Conservative Political Action Committee, and someone using intensely homophobic language in direct mail fundraising appeals, and one of the architects of the New Right, who was also gay. There were lots of others. I also have to remember that in the late 70s, the gay Republican organization was more developed and more visible in many ways than the gay Democratic organization. It was called Concerned Americans for Individual Rights, and it was a lot of people from the Ford administration who had founded that. Gay issues weren't seen as a partisan issue at that time.
That was way pre-log cabin.
Yes, very much so.
In your book, Body Counts, I noticed that while you talk about gay people who have since died or have come out, you don't out anybody, even arch conservatives from the era.
I mean, I think there are some people whose closets I pushed a bit in various parts of the book. But I didn't want the book. I wanted the book to tell a story and to depict an environment that I came out into and not get too sidetracked on, too focused on specific individuals.
Sean Stroob, eventually you go to New York, you go out to the bars. It's a wild and crazy time to be coming out. And what I notice in talking to younger people today, even though they know that a lot of the people who were having the wildest times eventually died of AIDS, they still wish they were there.
There is kind of almost a romanticized view of that time and a certain envy, the sense that the generation before them had this sort of unfettered sexual freedom without the concerns that they have today. That's not entirely true. You know, I remember being terrified of herpes. At least I knew so little about my body and my sexuality and sexually transmitted diseases and sexual health that it was all kind of a mystery, you know, putting together pieces of the puzzle a little bit at a time, which I think is somewhat different from gay people today when they come out and there's the internet. They're vastly better informed. So maybe the experiential end of it isn't quite as educational for them as it was for our generation.
I still remember being in a bathhouse once and looking at what was going on and said, thank God the extreme fundamentalist right wing don't know about this stuff.
Well, that's very important because the response to the epidemic by the gay community leadership, which was just kind of emerging at a national level, you know, through the 70s and post-Stonewall, was mostly local advocacy. The last thing it wanted to talk about was what gay men did sexually, particularly the bathhouses and multi-partnerism and promiscuity and commercial sex establishments and so on, because that was, of course, the crux of what the society hated about us. So even talking about the epidemic, there was a real active effort to disassociate the epidemic from anything that gay men were doing sexually. You know, there was, oh, well, this could have, you know, just as easily have hit housewives in Westchester first. It just coincidentally hit the gay community, which, of course, was not true at all. We had created a sexual ecology that was incredibly efficient at transmitting pathogens. And to a certain extent, promiscuity had become synonymous with liberation. I connect the epidemic in the broadest sense as a public health consequence in significant part due to the repression and the injustice imposed upon gay men. You can't criminalize, marginalize, stigmatize a part of the population, give it fewer chances in life, and treat it so poorly without ultimately there being some sort of public health consequence. And I think that's what we saw with the epidemic.
I remember at the start of the epidemic, there was a debate out here in California about whether the bathhouses should be open or closed. And what I found interesting is a lot of the straight liberals wanted to keep them open, and it was people who understood what was going on who wanted to shut them down.
Some. I mean, that's very complicated, and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it now. They certainly were almost the only place to reach a lot of gay men who could not be reached through the bars or community media or so on, that had no conscious connection to a gay community, weren't going to show up at a, you know, a gay clinic or whatever. So there was that opportunity to educate people. The bathhouses were enormously important in teaching people about safer sex and in establishing, to the extent that it could, a social norm of protecting one another. On the other hand, they were also places that were incredibly efficient at transmitting disease. And, you know, and some of the proprietors were more attentive and cared more about safer sex and that kind of educational work and practices than others. You know, the sex doesn't go away just because you close the bathhouse.
Sean Stroob, AIDS comes along for all of us until there was a point to get tested, really. We kind of shied away from it. I mean, you don't want to know you're going to die. It was a death sentence in the mid to late 80s. What kind of life do you think you would have led? I'm sure you thought about this. If it turned out that you had been negative.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I do talk about how the epidemic sort of hijacked my life. I wonder what would have happened if there hadn't been an epidemic at all. Would I have continued on the path in electoral politics? I think that even if I was negative, I was already engaged in the epidemic and in advocacy work in a modest way when I tested positive. And what really sort of ramped up my AIDS activism wasn't immediately after I tested positive. It was when my partner died. And I came into the epidemic as a political creature, you know, already engaged in activism and feminism and social justice work. So I think I probably would have been engaged in the epidemic. In any case, I don't think it would have been as central to my life as it has been or for so long.
I think also the epidemic and the reaction of the various institutions to the epidemic radicalized a lot of gay men as well.
Right. I think that for a lot of, you know, sort of for my demographic peers, right, so, you know, middle, upper middle class, you know, gay white guys living in, you know, big urban centers and the gay ghettos and so on, that basically were coming from a position of relative privilege. And yes, okay, so maybe they suffered some discrimination or whatever because they were gay. But really, AIDS was the first time they found the system not serving them in such a big way. And there was outrage. There was, you know, anger, and it translated into activism. But in, you know, most of the other communities being impacted by the epidemic, AIDS just had to kind of get in line. You know, they were already dealing with profound injustices and need. And so the work in those communities tended to be more intersectional from the beginning, as opposed to in gay white male communities where the epidemic was typically addressed in a more singular fashion.
Frank M. Robinson, who was Harvey Milk's speechwriter, has told me on more than one occasion that it's his feeling that Ronald Reagan committed genocide.
That's not a stretch as far as I'm concerned. I really believe it was, and I write about this in Body Counts, that it was a decision made to allow us to die, particularly Gary Bauer, who was Reagan's domestic policy advisor at the time. There's sort of a belief that, you know, the epidemic was kind of flushing out the weak and undesirable elements of society, people who use drugs, you know, gay people and so on. You know, Reagan didn't even utter the word publicly until 6 years into the epidemic. If we had had a different federal response, you know, from the beginning, we would be in a very, very different place today.
Sean Stroob, rewriting history seems to be something that's happening in an issue of PAWS Online. You talk about Kenneth Cole of AMFAR pretty much saying gay people did nothing and it was all Liz Taylor and this doctor who did everything in the early days. But it wasn't. It was gay men and, you know, their friends who did everything.
Ken Cole on the Chelsea Handler show said something about how he got involved because 25 years ago, gay men were too afraid to speak up, which was, first of all, so ridiculously and obviously inaccurate. I mean, we were getting arrested. We were, you know, we were doing everything we could to speak up and to get people to notice it as much as possible. And I don't think Ken Cole's comment was malicious, but it is typical of how what this community did in those early years has been forgotten. I think that those first years of the epidemic really showed the very, very best side of the LGBT community. I think the broader society could learn a lot from how we responded and came together and cared and loved and provided for those of us who were getting sick. So there is a kind of a mass amnesia about that, and it's, you know, much more palatable for public consumption for, you know, the Dallas Buyers Club to be about a straight white guy, you know, doing the stuff than a bunch of gay guys doing it or, you know, talking about the celebrities who were there. Elizabeth Taylor is very important. I'm not diminishing what she did, although she was far from the only person. Judith Light, you know, was somebody who has just been amazing from the very beginning and is still just as involved as she ever was. It's almost like an unwillingness to recognize what the LGBT community did because it requires recognizing us as a community loving and caring for each other instead of what a lot of people wanted to see it simply, you know, in sexual terms.
Larry Kramer in Normal Heart gives Ed Koch, mayor of New York at the time, a bad time. You pretty much gloss over Koch. Is it because you didn't see that much of it, or you figured that Cramer kind of handled that?
I wasn't directly involved in, you know, the interaction with the Koch administration. I was, you know, it was not in any position of leadership in the community, so I tried to write mostly about the things I was more directly involved in and knew about firsthand. You know, we have been so in touch with the failings of the Reagan administration, the Koch administration in New York, the pharmaceutical industry, government agencies, the media, rightfully so. But we haven't been as willing to look critically at our own community and our leadership and how we responded and the mistakes that we might have made or the things that we could learn from by looking back at how we did respond. And that interests me, not condemning anyone. I'm not sure, had I been in a position of leadership, that I would have done anything much different than, you know, some of the people and scenarios I describe in body counts and am criticizing. But I think it's important that we look at that and understand why we responded the way we did, why we were so afraid to talk about gay men's sexuality and what the consequences of that were.
As I was reading the book, I was pretty much stunned. I mean, you know, we know about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and certainly DOMA. But the Clinton administration's record, not just on gay rights, but on AIDS and Donna Shalala's record on AIDS, was absolutely atrocious. And that is played down. It's as if that part of history didn't happen.
Well, that's not played down in body counts. I address that in some detail. Part of what happened, that was really the beginning of when the LGBT community started to abandon the epidemic. You know, when Clinton ran in 1992 and the gay community delivered so much money for his campaign and he gets elected, and it was such an exciting, heady time. For the first time, we were on the inside, you know, and I think in many ways as a community, we've been more effective on the outside than when we are on the inside. Bob Hattoy, who was the man with AIDS who spoke at the 1992 Democratic Convention and very good friend and very important in PAS, and he went to work in the White House when Clinton was elected. He was the friend of Bill's who had AIDS. He said that, you know, the religious right is organizing pew by pew, and we're all attending cocktail parties trying to get our picture taken with Hillary. So what happened was that a lot of our leadership kind of got co-opted by being brought in on the inside, and the AIDS issues were, you know, dealt with strictly in political terms as a political opportunity, not the crisis of human need that it was. The example I address in considerable detail is the failure to lift the ban on federal funding for needle exchange, which, yes, was a contentious issue. The science was utterly clear. But the Clinton administration went so far with Donna Shalala, Secretary of Health and Human Services, even to try and raise questions about the science. And it was just a really cynical approach to it and a cowardice and unwillingness to expend their political capital on behalf of something so important. In fact, it became so intense that the president's own Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS that he appointed wrote a letter of no confidence in the administration because of their unwillingness to do this and a number of other things that were so obviously needed. Clinton's, you know, so-called welfare reform hurt more people with HIV and probably did a lot to extend the epidemic. Yes, he's a Democrat. Yes, he was certainly better than the alternatives available at the time. But that doesn't mean someone gets a pass. It doesn't mean we can't be honest about the history and look at it critically.
You mentioned the gay leadership was off busy doing cocktail parties. We hear about A-list gays in HRC today. Some things haven't changed.
Well, you know, I write in the book about the story of how I got Tennessee Williams to sign the first fundraising letter for the Human Rights Campaign Fund when it started just as a PAC. But then, you know, what happened in the 70s when I came out into a gay community, you know, we'll speak just in terms of the men first, that the people who could come out of the closet generally were kind of one end of the privilege spectrum or the other, right? There were either people who had some level of privilege. They didn't worry quite as much about losing their job, or they were well-educated. You know, they knew whatever the consequences were, they could withstand them and go on with their lives. Or people at the other end who had absolutely nothing to lose by coming out. You know, the factory worker, the middle class, the working class in the middle was where the risk was the greatest. And so we created a movement facilitated by the epidemic that enabled all sorts of people to come out, the great mass in the middle to come out. And the priorities of the movement then began to reflect much more about, you know, middle America. And it became about marriage equality and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And, you know, things like the epidemic were complicated. They were indivisible from issues of racism and sexism and economic justice. And they sort of became inconvenient issues and got sidelined. And the LGBT community went on to other things.
Well, you mentioned Tennessee Williams. Just want to say that he signed a very, very early and very important letter, fundraising letter, for the gay community. And that kind of astonished me that, of all people, it was Tennessee Williams who was the first celebrity to actually do that.
The first openly gay celebrity. And, you know, when we were trying to think of who would sign this letter, there's a little group of us working on this, that Gregory King and I were at this one dinner, and we were the two youngest guys there. We were, you know, 22 or something. And we were insisting that it had to be someone openly gay. There were other non-gay allies at the time. But then we couldn't think of anybody who was openly gay, who was, you know, sort of widely known, nationally known. And Gregory suggested Gore Vidal, who was known to be, as he described it, homophile. But he was rumored to be intending to run for the Senate from California in 82, which he ultimately did. And we didn't know any way of reaching him. And I had an acquaintance with Tennessee Williams, so I suggested Tennessee Williams and got him. But our backup, we literally could not think of a third person. Christopher Isherwood was mentioned, but he wasn't well known. You know, we were one to mail this fundraising letter to, you know, the ACLU and Common Cause and Now, sort of progressive donors. We needed someone that would know. Our backup, if I wasn't able to get Tennessee Williams, was not a gay person, but it was someone who was seen as an ally, an important ally. It was David Susskind, who had a talk show at the time. But that just shows the dearth of role models, you know, the phrase, that there was absolutely no one in national public life of significant stature to be appropriate for that letter who was openly gay.
Just an aside, your story toward the end of the book about hanging out with Gore Vidal and Ravello, I got to meet him a couple of times, and, you know, we hear all sorts of things, but, you know, he was a doll with me. It was great. And he was as witty privately as publicly.
Oh, just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant mind, complicated individual. I do like one story when John Berendt and I were visiting him in Ravello. John Berendt wrote Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. We spent a very long day drinking a lot of alcohol. We were there, I think, 13 or 14 hours, and we ended up back at La Rondinaia, his villa, which sort of clung onto the side of a cliff overlooking the Sea of Salerno. And at about 1 in the morning, I had to go to the bathroom, and I get up to go to the bathroom, and Gore says, no, you'll wake Howard, his partner Howard, who had gone to bed. And he said, just piss out the window. Okay, so the window has this little tiny Juliet balcony. And I go over to the window, looking out into this, you know, dark, you know, midnight sky, and the sort of twinkle of little boats off in the Sea of Salerno. And then John said he needed to urinate as well, so he comes, stands next to me at the window. And then Gore comes over, and the three of us are standing there at the window, pissing out over this little Juliet balcony down onto a lower level, onto a skylight on a lower level of the palazzo. And then Gore, with his free hand, was pointing out an island in the Sea of Salerno, the lights on it, where Rudolf Nureyev had lived and had owned a property. It was a pretty cool evening, actually.
Sean Strube, okay, in the mid-90s, you almost died, and, you know, you thought you were dying, and of course, when you were resurrected in this chapter called Lazarus, you had to rethink your entire life. You're not alone. A lot of people I know around 95, 96, I figured I was saying goodbye to them, and I wasn't, and they're still alive today and healthy. In terms of HIV medications, where are we now?
Where are we now is that someone who acquires HIV today, who has access to health care, an important caveat, can expect to live a normal lifespan. It is a manageable chronic illness. The side effects, we don't know the long-term side effects of these meds. Nobody has taken them for 20 years. We don't know what it means to you know, take them for decades, for a lifetime, or interactions with all sorts of other maintenance medications people might be taking. But the short-term side effects, the tolerability side effects, are far, far less severe than they once were. You know, I really find that most people who start on meds today experience little, if any, difficulty taking those meds in the you know, sort of immediate time frame. But the problem is, so how do you communicate to people that you don't want to get this virus, right? It screws up your life. It's a health challenge. It requires expensive medication. It's stigmatizing beyond belief. And yet also at the same time communicating that if you do get it, you still can lead a vibrant, active, vital life. And too often the prevention messaging boils down to either, you know, this sort of scary, you know, HIV is the worst thing that can happen to you, this kind of, you know, ogre of a boogeyman out there, or it's no big deal. You just take a pill and you can go on with your life. Neither is true. You know, I always say that the focus should be on emphasizing that acquiring HIV is a life-changing event. It is a big deal in terms of your life. But if it does happen to you, your life goes on and you can fall in love and have a family and have a career and expect to live a normal lifespan.
What is safe sex today? I mean, we know about what they talked about years ago, but where are we on that today?
People have long been doing their own risk analysis in their head, right? It's difficult to apply one standard of safe sex to everybody because people make those judgments themselves. You know, for a long time, you know, people were told to use condoms for oral sex, and very few people ever did so. Yet you still call, you know, health departments and ask, and they'll say, oh, yes, absolutely, you must use oral condoms for oral sex. Today, if someone is on treatment and their virus is suppressed in their blood successfully, they have an undetectable viral load. There has not yet been a single documented case of someone with an undetectable viral load transmitting the virus sexually. It may be possible for that to happen. We know that people with a very low viral load have been able to have transmitted sexually. But the chance is so remote. Yesterday was the 6th anniversary of something called the Swiss Statement, when the Swiss Federal AIDS Commission issued a statement saying that serodiscordant couples, where one is positive and one is negative, where the one who's positive has been on treatment and undetectable for at least 6 months, and they're monogamous, and there are no other sexually transmitted infections in the relationship, that in the opinion of the Swiss Federal AIDS Commission, they don't need to use condoms. Because their HIV prevention strategy comes from a position in part that is, how do we help return people with HIV to as normal a life as possible, including expanding the circle of safe intimacy and sexual safety for them. So today, and just recently, the Centers for Disease Control has agreed in principle to stop referring to all sex without condoms as unsafe sex, because people can virtually eliminate the chance of HIV transmission by taking meds and having an undetectable viral load, or in some cases, people who take pre-exposure prophylaxis, people who are HIV negative and want to make sure they don't become positive and they take these meds. There are all sorts of complications with that, in addition to the expense and potential long-term side effects. There are other good reasons to use condoms because there are other sexually transmitted diseases. But today the options are much greater. I think that the use a condom every time message has become like white noise. It's like just say no to drugs. And, you know, too much of the prevention messaging is this kind of, you know, melodramatic, overly hyped kind of thing. Like, you know, I was taught that, oh, my God, you smoke a joint and 2 weeks later you're going to be slamming heroin. Eventually I learned that wasn't true, you know, and so it made me suspicious of the messaging I got around that. I think that's what happens with the HIV prevention messages, that we're not being really honest with people about gradations of risk and giving them the practical information they need to conduct their own risk analysis in a more effective way.
Sean Strube, what do you think about HIV deniers? Are they now on a plane with, like, you know, climate change deniers?
That's a phrase that encompasses a sort of wide range of beliefs. People who don't believe the virus exists, people who believe it exists but that it is benign. I'm not one of these people who goes out and attacks people who have these extreme or unusual views, because some of what they say, you know, they're half-truths, and like half a brick, you can throw it twice as far. I think that we have not been as attentive as we should be in talking about the side effects of the medication. I think a lot of people are overtreated, take more medication than is necessary. And the whole denialist discussion and people who in some cases are just plain loony has made it more difficult to talk about the complications of treatment. I have always viewed my own treatment strategy as what's the least amount of antiretroviral medication I can make and keep my viral load undetectable. You know, I don't tend to find these arguments between people with HIV when they're comparing, you know, their treatment regimens. One of my best friends had a very different approach to treatment. He tried everything as it came out, and his body was like a laboratory. And I've always been a little more reluctant around treatment. We never argued about that. It was always about sharing information and understanding that, you know, we could have very different paths that were perfectly appropriate for each of us.
And that friend died.
And that friend did die.
Sean Stroob, a couple of other questions about your fascinating life. You witnessed John Lennon lying there after being shot, and you were interviewed several times about that 1980. Many years later, you were with Yoko Ono at some AIDS events. Did you ever talk about that day?
No, I never have talked about it with Yoko. I was walking back to my apartment on Manhattan's West Side that evening when I heard the shots, and I was one of the first people on the scene. It was horrific, obviously, and traumatizing, and continues to reverberate in my life in unusual ways, and including with stalkers and things like that. But what happened about 11 or 12 years later, I had produced a play off-Broadway called The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, David Drake's play, which we later produced here in San Francisco at the Fort Mason Theater. Yoko Ono came to see the play, and she sent me a note saying how wonderful it was, and if she could do anything to help promote it, she'd be happy to. Well, I wasn't going to miss that opportunity, so I responded. We were then just starting the treatment action group and asked if she would, you know, chair a benefit performance of the play for that. Great. We organized it. Invitations are out. It's all going along swimmingly. And about 10 days before the event, I think it was ABC, started doing a promo that they had gotten an interview with Mark David Chapman, who had killed John Lennon. And that interview was going to air the very same evening as our benefit. Now, I had been dealing with Yoko's assistant, and I didn't know if they knew my sort of tangential connection. And I was a little bit worried that, you know, the night of that benefit or somebody would ask her something, and it would just be kind of like this sort of weird thing. And so I asked her assistant. It was an awkward conversation. And he responded, you know, Yoko knows exactly who you are, and just forget about it. We're going to have a good evening. And she came to the benefit. It was a mass of press outside because of Yoko and because of the, you know, the Chapman interview. And she was amazing. There was an ounce of diva in her. She had designed a T-shirt that she gave to us to raise money for TAG. And she was just as gracious and talked to everybody. And it was really great. It was just somebody who absolutely, you know, who wanted to help. There was nothing else other than she just wanted to help. And whatever we had asked her to do, she was willing to do.
Sean Stroob, a lot of the latter part of the book does deal with treatments and with the interaction of you as publisher of PAWS and your work on PAWS magazine and Big Pharma. It's a broad subject that probably would require several hours to really truly discuss, but how do you deal with this giant industry that on the one hand creates drugs that keep us alive and on the other hand kills us too?
It is a peculiar relationship. I mean, the way we dealt with it at PAWS was just a belief and a mantra, and anybody who ever worked at PAWS over the years certainly heard me say this often, that every day we had to be prepared to shut the magazine down rather than feel like we had compromised in some way. And at any given time, you know, one or more of the drug companies were angry with us, and they tried in various ways to influence our coverage, including at one time my sister, who was sold the advertising to the drug companies for us, was told about an effort by one drug company to try and enlist other drug companies to all pull their ads so that they could shut us down. But, you know, initially we would write about side effects or, you know, some unattractive side of one of these drugs, and we'd get letters from lawyers for the drug. You can't say that. There's no scientific proof that what you're saying, whatever. And that quickly changed because they learned that we were, first of all, responsible in our journalism, and that we were kind of like an early warning system, that when we started talking about protease paunch, the redistribution of fat for people taking protease inhibitors or other side effects, that it usually meant this was something they were going to have to deal with. And, you know, it was complicated because initially, you know, in the first year, we didn't have any advertising for any antiretroviral drugs. You know, the model, the business model was, you know, much broader, and we thought we'd have gay advertisers and so on and so forth. And they all went away as the magazine really became about serving people with HIV, not just gay people. And we became reliant on the pharmaceutical advertising. But very seldom have people criticized our coverage because we were known as such a critic of the drug companies. You know, we have this, you know, this, the new hepatitis C drug just came out. It's $1,000 a day. $1,000 a day. You know, Abbott right now is in this litigation over when they quadrupled or quintupled the cost of their Norvir, and they got in litigation with another drug company. This whole concept of this unfettered capitalism, where it was absolutely whatever can be gotten away with. There is no sense of conscience in the pricing. The only conscience is what can be gotten away with. Every year there's a day on Capitol Hill in Washington, the AIDS drug assistance programs. And through funding from pharmaceutical companies, people with HIV from all over the country are brought to Washington to lobby Congress to support this big appropriation to provide AIDS drugs for people through these state programs. It's incredibly important. All sorts of people I know are alive because of these programs. But you have to see it kind of more broadly. If we tried to organize a day on Capitol Hill to advocate for generics or for price controls or for other measures, it'd be a very lonely effort. You know, so the pharmaceutical industry provides the funding for us to lobby for something that we need to save our lives, and it keeps us from focusing on more fundamental systemic changes that ultimately are what we need.
And the irony is that many of these drugs exist because these companies got federal funding.
Because they got federal funding. And also, you know, another thing that really became clear to me in writing Body Counts, and I look back at my own activism and, you know, particularly with ACT UP, which was very important to me. I don't think I'd be alive if I hadn't been involved in ACT UP. But I also realize now that of all the demonstrations we did and, you know, breaking into offices and all of our hijinks and whatever at the different drug companies and so on, we never did anything that was a scratch on them compared to the incredible benefit we provided to them by doing their deregulatory work for them. In the 1980s was the Reagan era of deregulation of every industry. And because we wanted access to drugs in the pipeline, because we were dying otherwise, and we should have been able to access those and make the choice ourselves to take that risk, we ended up facilitating a certain extent deregulation of the drug development process, certainly made it much faster to bring drugs to market, so that more often today we find out about side effects in the marketplace after they've been approved. Now, that's not such a great consequence of what we did, but we were struggling for our survival at the time. So this is where, you know, looking back at this history becomes so important, and understanding unintended consequences of our activism and trying to think of what we're doing today in that broader context.
Sean Strube, currently you're working on something called Sero Project. What is it?
Sero Project is a network of people with HIV and allies fighting for freedom from stigma, discrimination, and injustice. We principally have been involved in combating a phenomenon known as HIV criminalization, which is the inappropriate use of a person's HIV-positive status in a criminal prosecution. For example, if someone spits at someone, right? Not very attractive behavior, certainly appropriate for some sort of sanction, but it is not going to kill anybody. And yet, in Texas, Willie Campbell is sitting in a prison cell today, about 5 or 6 years into a 35-year sentence for spitting at someone. Last year, David Plunkett in New York State got out of prison after serving 6.5 years for spitting at someone. An appeals court finally ruled that saliva could not be considered a deadly weapon in the state of New York. About two-thirds of the states have HIV-specific criminal statutes that only apply to people with HIV. A lot of them are around mandating disclosure before someone has sex. First of all, creating different criminal statutes based on an immutable characteristic, whether it's skin color, gender, sexual orientation, physical ability, or genetic makeup, is a really bad idea. But we're doing that right now. We're creating an underclass in the law around this one virus. Secondly, there are all sorts of sexually transmitted pathogens which, if left untreated, can seriously harm or kill someone. More women in the U.S. last year died of cervical cancer from HPV, human papillomavirus, than died of AIDS from HIV. But HIV is uniquely stigmatized, associated with an outlaw sexuality, with gay men, with people of color, with people who use drugs. And the law and the criminal justice system reflects that stigma. So you have people with HIV who are now, basically all of us, are one disgruntled ex-partner away from finding ourselves in a courtroom. Nick Rhodes in Iowa used a condom. He had an undetectable viral load and was convicted for not disclosing in advance. He posed no risk of transmission, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Fortunately, after a year, the judge let him out, but he has lifetime sex offender registration. He wears an ankle bracelet. He can't leave his home county. He can't be around children unsupervised. He has to take lie detector tests administered by the state of Iowa several times a year, detailing every sexual contact, including his fantasies. Carrie Thomas is on the board of the Sarah Project, incarcerated presently in Idaho, 3 years into a 30-year sentence. He used a condom. He had an undetectable viral load. Rarely in these cases is there HIV transmission. Very often there's not even any potential risk of transmission. This is just another manifestation of the idea that we solve every social problem by locking up some segment of society. After combination therapy came out, up until then, people with AIDS, regardless of whatever the moral judgment or whatever people, there was an expectation that we were going to die, possibly horrific deaths. And as the realization sort of seeped into the society that we were not dying any longer and that we could live these lives, the perception of people with HIV changed, where increasingly, particularly through the criminal justice system and the public health system, we are being seen as an inherent threat, as inherently dangerous, because we were living longer. That meant we were around to infect longer. We're being defined as viral vectors, potential infectors. And this criminalization is the result of that trend, and it is getting worse, even though we now have some advocacy to try and combat it.
Sean Stroob, speaking of getting worse, when we look at what's going on regarding gay men in both Africa and in Russia, we're seeing this horrible pushback at times being funded and promoted by American evangelists, but Putin obviously is doing this in order to find an eternal enemy. And how do we combat that?
Well, I think a good place to start combating it is getting our own house in order. We have horrific human rights abuses right here in this country. I think that a significant amount of what we've seen in Africa, in Uganda, and elsewhere has been greatly exacerbated by evangelicals from the U.S., funded through things like PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief in Africa, the supposedly signature accomplishment of the George Bush administration, much of which is delivered through so-called faith-based organizations that we ended up funding the evangelism and the proselytizing under the guise of healthcare delivery in Africa and creating these networks and bringing those intensely homophobic values to, in many cases, opportunistic politicians. I mean, in terms of how we deal with them in those countries, I always start with, let's deal with it first here in the United States and stop putting people in jail for decades for behaviors that pose no risk to anyone. But otherwise, we deal with it the way we deal with other human rights issues, through diplomacy, through trade pressure and trade agreements, and there's a whole array of tools that can be deployed. We don't hold human rights abuses around sexual freedom issues as high a priority as we do other kinds of human rights abuses. We tend to be pretty selective in where we choose to criticize another country's human rights record, but that's the way it is, I guess.
Sean Stroob, one final question. When you write a book, a memoir about your own life, and you come out of it from the other side, what kind of new insights, what kind of changes in you occurred just simply by going back, writing the book, and kind of assessing where you are now? I mean, you still have many, many years to go, hopefully, and, it's not like it's over, but it's like something is moving on.
Right. I mean, I think it sort of on a personal level, going through this sort of helped make sense of my life, and I you know, gained a real understanding. I write about abuse issues as a child and even as an adult, and that I think had more of an effect on me than maybe I realized for much of my life. So there was that, you know, sort of in a personal way. You know, I really feel that it is important for those of us, you know, who were there and on the front lines for so long to tell our stories. If we don't, we're going to be subject to, you know, the interpretation of others. And, of course, there are so many, you know, who are not able to tell those stories. So I feel an obligation, if not a compulsion, to do that for so many. But I also think that, you know, if there's a trajectory to my activism and my consciousness around social change, you know, it's the interconnectedness of these things. People want to talk about attacking, you know, age-related stigma. Well, stigma. What good is it to fix age-related stigma or to address that when you're not dealing with other kinds of stigma? You know, in the U.S., we had to set up a sort of parallel service delivery structure because the existing healthcare system was not serving us at all. But globally, this whole effort creating these disease-specific, HIV-specific programs in countries where the healthcare needs are so basic and so much broader than that, I think people are starting to understand that that's a mistake, that we need to do more with basic healthcare infrastructure and see health problems in communities in a more holistic way. So I guess the interconnectedness of all these things, I don't see any of this work in as singular a way as maybe I once did.
Sean Strube, now you've finished this book, you're still working with Sero Project, and you're still on the board and writing for PAWS magazine. Thinking about other books?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I'm really enjoying the tour, you know. I really enjoy the interaction with people and the questions and the discussion about these issues, and particularly with long-term survivors. Maybe there'll be another book. We'll see if anybody buys this one. I hope they will. I think it's a pretty good read.
You've been listening to an interview with Sean Strube, whose book is titled Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.